The headline test in my case was it would point exactly to who this happened to, and I did not want the whole world to know that I was damaged goods. Me knowing that in my mind at the time was quite enough.
Everybody, Doc Brian here, and welcome to Doc Talks, where we talk about people's troubles, trials, tribulations, and hopefully triumphs in life. We're here in LifeWord Studios, broadcasting in over 160 languages to 127 countries to a listening audience of 2 billion people. You can find all of our Christian content at lifeword.org. Today, we have a very special guest with us. We have Adam Barron. Adam, so great to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so we've known each other for just a little bit of time here. We went to Man Alive together and got to experience God's presence in that environment. I've seen you on the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which you're a black belt, I believe.
Yes, sir.
So you're probably the most dangerous person in this building right now. So, I want you to just, as we talk about trauma and we talk about mental health, kind of bring us into the conversation of the trauma or the mental health applications that you have dealt with in your life.
Sure. So I grew up in Northern California into a Christian family, and we moved to Arkansas when I was about 14 years old. My parents, my father worked in construction. He was a member of the Glassworkers Union in San Francisco. He was the guy that you would see up on a skyscraper putting in windows 60 stories up. And he broke his back essentially doing that and had to kind of forcibly retire. And the only employment he could find was in Arkansas at my uncle's restaurant he was opening. So we ended up out in Siloam Springs. And when I was about 14 and a half or so, there was one kind of fateful night when my grandfather invited me to his house along with some university students. And we were playing pool and things like that. And then my grandfather offered to take me home after everybody had left. He showed me some video content I never should have ever seen, and then I was molested by my grandfather. And that began a very unhealthy downward spiral in my life, being 14 and a half and just feeling like damaged goods. It was a long time of some good counseling and honestly just growth experiences through missions work and meeting some key people in my life that helped me come out of that, and really just the grace of God, God showing up at really important key moments in my life.
Yeah. So when we talk about at 14 years old, being sexually assaulted, a lot of times people of that age range, they're already in that mindset of what really is sex and what really isn't sex. Now, of course, we know that's something reserved for marriage.
Yes.
Between a man and a woman. But when things like that happen, especially from someone that they trust, it begins to be very confusing about, is this wrong? Do you recall ever being in that kind of wave point of saying, well, this is my grandfather, it must be okay?
Not really, actually. I knew that what he was doing was wrong, but there's just a paralyzation of fear. I was just completely paralyzed by fear. I had no idea what to do. I just knew that this was my grandfather who I'd known my whole life and who I'd respected. I knew he was a respected member of the community. I knew that he'd been a missionary for several years, which, as it turned out, unfortunately, you know, his activities had gone on in the mission field as well, we found out later. And I knew exactly this is wrong, but I didn't know what to do about it. And at that moment, I just froze.
Yeah. So then we get into kind of that cognitive dissonance that, you know, it's wrong, but it's my grandfather. He's well respected. You know, what do I do? And sometimes there's the fear of, if I do tell, are they going to believe me? Did you have any of that going on in your mind at that point?
That I absolutely did have. There was an instant fear of, to your point, will they believe me? But also, what will happen if they do? What's going to happen to me? I live in a town of, at the time, Siloam Springs, I think, was 1,500 people or so. I was the only grandson in town. I was I knew my career path a little bit at that point. I figured I'm going to go into journalism. So thinking from a news writing hat, you can't mention a minor, but you can mention a young male relative. There was exactly one of those in Siloam Springs, Arkansas. I mean, you're looking at him. So I was quite scared about what would happen if the news came out. I'm thinking with, you know, the headline test, which we hear in the corporate world all the time. Well, let's pass the headline test. Mm-hmm. The headline test in my case was it would point exactly to who this happened to. And I did not want the whole world to know that I was damaged goods. Me knowing that in my mind at the time was quite enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, you've said damaged goods twice now. And I'm sure, and I'm not trying to downplay anything, but you know now that that didn't make you damaged goods.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, I mean, what really comes in is the greatest threat of the enemy, which is guilt. I must have done something, or I didn't do something to make this not happen. And then the shame aspect of it, of that I allowed it to happen. So that's the perfect setup from the enemy, is that we have guilt because I shouldn't have, but we got the shame because we did. And so the resolve, the cure, if you will, for guilt and shame is confession. Mm-hmm. So at what point did that come?
I was 19 years old. I'd graduated from high school. I'd gotten a full ride to the University of Arkansas, and I had no desire to be there whatsoever. I just had... A lot had happened in those intervening years between that event and 18 years old, and I just bombed out of college. Didn't want to be there. I had three friends of mine, none of whom were connected to one another, on the same day mentioned an organization called Youth with a Mission. And I didn't really know what to make of that. I heard of it that day, but I was away from the Lord at this point, and I thought, you know, there must be something that he's trying to tell me. Maybe I should go check this out. So I ended up writing to them. You know, this is the late 90s. Yeah. You have to write to people. You can't just email them.
Yeah.
But I wrote to them, asked them for an application. They sent me an application packet. You know, I applied. I was accepted. Ended up in Kona, Hawaii, which, roughing it for Jesus, right? But it was about 3 weeks into that time that I met a speaker come. His name was Frank Naya, who eventually went on to become the president of that organization. But he was speaking to us about the love of God. And in the middle of his second day, he just stopped. And he just felt a prompting from the Lord. We're all going to circle up. We're going to stop talking. We're going to circle up. We're going to hold hands. And I'm going to walk around in this circle, and I'm going to pray for each of you. And so he started praying around the circle, and various things started happening. One guy just bolted, just ran. Another one roared like a lion. Another one collapsed weeping. And by this time, I'm shaking. I have no idea what's going to happen. I've never experienced anything like this in my life. I mean, so he comes to me, and he stops in front of me, puts his hand on my shoulder. He starts to pray, and then he just rears back and slaps me full force in the chest. Now, this is a 6'4", 350-pound Samoan man. So it had some force behind it. But he hit me once, and it just kind of shocked me. And then he hit me the second time. And the only thing I can describe is it was like God reached down through my throat and just yanked all of the pain that came with that event at 14 out of me. And he said something very distinct to me later on. I have plans for you, and those were getting in the way. We needed them gone. Yeah. And it wasn't going to happen on its own. It was at that moment that I was able to come to terms with the fact that, yes, it happened, but I'm not damaged goods anymore. I have the attention of the Lord, the God who loves me, the God who sees me. And at that point, I just recognized that, obviously, if there's a higher purpose for me from the Lord, then I must be worthy. And, yes, I'm a sinner, but he wants to use me.
You know, I think a lot of times we forget about Paul, you know, in the Bible, that he was killing Christians or finding them to kill them. And then he does a complete, you know, 180, and now he is trying to make people Christians. And I think that we forget about that in our circumstances of, hey, this has happened to me, and because this has happened, I can never do X for the Lord, whatever that may be. And we get caught in that trap. So if at that point, did you share that story with your parents or anybody in your family?
So my parents and I had been on strained terms since that event. My father had left shortly before this event occurred. He didn't leave town. He was still in town. He was still working for my uncle at the family restaurant, but he and my mother had separated. They hadn't gotten a divorce, but they had separated. So this kind of had to, it brought them back together, kind of forced them back together in a way. They didn't blame me, but I felt blamed, not just by them, but by a lot of the family, especially the family that had lived in town for a long time. My mother definitely blamed my dad. I could tell. My dad blamed himself. And, of course, he blamed his father as well. But there was a schism that just got wider and wider over time. I started to feel like, well, maybe if my dad had protected me better, maybe if he, you know, had been there more. My mom looked at it the same way. So by the time I was 18, and then my parents did officially get a divorce, and unfortunately it happened to where kind of the key moment in that divorce occurred when I was dead in the middle of a situation that arose with email and my dad speaking to other women on the internet. My mother used me to pull up his email. My dad walked in, saw what was going on, and I essentially just told them both, I don't want anything to do with either of you anymore. I'm leaving. And so for a couple years, I lived on a friend's floor, just crashed on couches where I could find one. And by the time I got back from YWAM, I was ready to talk to my parents, but there was still a lot of distance there.
Yeah, so, and during talking to them, how did that all play out?
My father had remarried at this point, unfortunately, to a woman who was a drug dealer. My mother was seeing a man who she ended up becoming engaged to and then did not marry. They ended up having a falling out. I didn't feel like I really fit, and I didn't have a place. If anything, I just kind of felt like I was an inconvenience. So I did talk to them about my experience, talked to them a little bit about what happened, how God used that experience in my life. But it was a guarded conversation. I didn't really feel like I could open up to my parents just because I felt like they have their own issues right now. I don't really feel like they need to want to hear about what happened with me over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said you just feel like you didn't fit, like you didn't have a place. And I think that so many men in particular feel that way. They're just in this world and it's them against the world. How did that feeling of not fitting come through by the way of Christ to show you that you did fit, that there was a community for you?
I spent a long time not feeling like I fit. I went to college, ended up going to John Brown University and getting my degree there in broadcasting. I felt like I fit there, but I knew that it was temporary. I knew these people are all going to leave and they're going to go about their lives. And so while I made some great friends, I was always still very guarded in who Adam really is. I knew that I probably wouldn't live in Salem Springs forever. And so even the friendships I had there, I kind of almost started preparing myself to leave, and which we did. We ended up moving to Conway. My wife's a Conway native, and so we ended up making our way down here when she became chronically ill. Got a new job here and really just struggled to find a group of men, group of friends to connect with. You might know Cody Sublett. He was one of the people who was the first ones to just kind of grab me and make me be his friend, yeah. Which was very Cody. But really, it wasn't until a few years ago that I started to kind of find the group of men that I could really feel like I fit with, to get back to the question of fitting in. It was just a couple years ago that I really started to discover that group of people and open up to them and start to actually own my story and not be ashamed of it.
Yeah. So were you actively looking for a group of people, or did they find you?
They found me. And I would really say that God knew exactly what I needed. He knew when I needed it the most, and then he made it happen in the way that he does. Yeah. It was really the group of guys that encouraged me to come to Man Alive. I met Ryan Stevens, and I met Rob Heffley, and I met a lot of these guys, and they just made me a part of their team, their group of guys, you know, their band of brothers. And it was then that it's just God started just putting me with people, whether I wanted to be there or not. He started putting me with these men, and God is good. I am so grateful for the people that he led me to, because they've just become integral parts of my life and extremely valuable brothers.
Yeah. So I can tell you from my experience of the trauma that I've dealt with, was the turning point for me was when I told them my story and how big of a shame that there was, that their facial expression did not change at all. It was almost as if, well, we've heard this before. And that was the most healing property in any of that that I experienced. What was that like for you when you first just entrusted them with this trauma?
It was difficult. It was difficult because I knew that there's going to be people in this group that have more, I guess, you know, more traumatizing stories than me. Maybe they went through like dramatic physical abuse, or even people with less traumatic stories than me. I have some friends that have come to Man Alive with me who said, you know, I can't really relate to a lot of this. I had a great upbringing. I didn't really have any major issues in my life. But when I sat down and told my story, it was freeing, I guess, is the only way I can think of to put it. Looking around, like you said, at these guys and seeing that there's not judgment in their eyes. There's not a lessened opinion of me in their eyes. It was more just a, man, brother, we're with you. Hate that that happened to you, but glad to see that God has redeemed you and has actually turned that bad into a good.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the key thing is there to remember is that we are not what we have done or what has happened to us. We are who we are today because of those experiences that brought healing and redemption, you know, to a point. So tell us about what you do today. How are you, you're working with a nonprofit, you're doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu with Graybeard Forge, if I can get it out.
It's so, a mouthful.
Yeah, it is. It is. Tell us a little bit about that. How did that all transpire?
About the same time that I really got to know Rob Heffley, or started getting to know him, you know, Ryan Stevens and I had been just kind of bantering back and forth with the idea of, you know, it'd be great to do something together one of these days. You know, we're like-minded. We both love the Lord. We love this martial art, and we've seen what it can do to help, you know, combat veterans, law enforcement, or just people out there, the general public, what it can do to help them create brotherhood, you know, heal from some emotional trauma. There's nothing like taking you out of your stressful life, like another man trying to strangle you. Mm-hmm. And it pulls you out of all the stresses of life and really makes you focus on that moment.
Yeah.
To where by the time an hour has passed, you've hit the reset button for the day. Mm-hmm. So we had been bantering this back and forth, and then all of a sudden Rob just pulls me aside one day in the school pickup line at Conway Christian, says, I want you to come see something. And he takes me to this building, and it's just a big former fence company, empty warehouse. He said, I want to put a jiu-jitsu gym in here. What do you think about being a part of that? Ryan mentioned that he would really like to do this with you. I'd been praying for that for about a year, knowing that the gym that I was at, I wasn't going to be there a lot longer. I just felt the Lord pulling me away. And so, you know, at that moment, that was when it was like, okay, the Lord is answering my prayer. You know, he's going to make this happen, because I know Rob Heffley. If he sets his mind to something, he's going to pursue it. So it's been fantastic just watching a lot of the people that come through, military vets, active law enforcement, you know, retired law enforcement, first responders, and just the general public all getting together in this space, getting to teach them something, because that's my role. Is I manage the gym, but then I'm also, you know, one of the primary instructors. Getting to teach them something, getting to see them interact with one another, and getting to see, especially the people that don't know the Lord, see these men who do know the Lord, and see who they are as human beings, as men, and that rubs off on them. And relationships are start to be, you know, being built. And really for me, it's great, because my goal with all of this is I just want to use these skills that I have for the Lord.
Yeah, you know, I have, at Man Alive, I've seen you and Ryan Stevens teaching some I guess you would call it defensive tactics.
Yeah.
There at Man Alive, and I try to look from afar because I'm a lover, not a fighter. I would shoot you before I would fight you. You know, that's just kind of where I'm at this stage of life. which you're older than me, I think. So, you really begin to see. Well, for instance, there was this last time at Man Alive in March of last year, there were two guys who were just being really rough with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And Ryan stopped and he said, "Now, guys, remember, we're friends, not enemies."
Yeah.
You know, and so I can only imagine that in this, would you call it sparring?
Yeah.
That in the sparring that some times when men get put in that vulnerable position or they get caught, if you will, hemmed up, whatever you want to use, is that some of that trauma begins to be triggered and they might get angry.
Yes.
So in those teaching moments, because that's a teaching moment, how do you help them process through that?
Stop. Just stop. If I see that coming, just stop. Say, just breathe. We're friends. I'm not going to hurt you. I might cause you some pain. I'm not going to hurt you. Breathe, relax. We're just training.
Yeah.
And because you're right, we absolutely do see sometimes those triggers hit from the trauma that they've experienced. Maybe something happened when they were on their back and somebody was literally like sitting on their chest, knees on the ground, and there's a position in jiu-jitsu where we call that mount, and it's a key offensive position. You're not on offense when you're on the bottom in that position. You will see people that will become triggered, especially in that position, and it's just a reminder that, hey, listen, I'm going to take care of you. You know, we're sparring here, but at the same time, man, I'm not going to hurt you. And then afterwards, it's usually just grab them and talk about it. You know, I'm not going to try to force anything out of them, but just say, hey, you know, are you okay? Is everything all right? You know, just, I want to make sure that you walk out of here having had a positive experience today, and just address it head on with them, not in a confrontational fashion, but just in a way that's very much empathetic. Mm-hmm. Because I remember when I was starting jiu-jitsu, I had a real problem being on my back because that's the position that I was in when my grandfather molested me.
Sure.
And it just brought back that reminder. And over time, I actually realized I need to turn that into my strong position. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did eventually. And now it's funny, like Ryan can hardly get me to get off my back. So, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, it is amazing with even within psychology is that when we take that we see to be the weakest part of it and we make it the strongest part of us, how everything begins to just flip in our mindset about what happened. One thing that I like to ask people, and hopefully most of the time they give me the right answer, not that there's a right or wrong answer, but if you could go back to the moment at 14 years old when this happened, would you change anything?
It's a difficult question. I didn't want to be molested. It would be hard not to tell my younger self, run out that door right now. It's not that far to walk home. But at the same time, it's a big part of the man that I became.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, that story that I told, God has used that to change a few people's lives. Mm-hmm. He's used that as a way for me to help people. He's used that as a way to help me have perspective in my dealings with men who are struggling, who have, like me, felt like damaged goods or feel like damaged goods now. So it would be selfish of me in a way to try to change that, because God used that in my life. Who am I to take something that God used for good away? But also it's helped in other people's lives as a way to help, you know, give me empathy for them and help them understand that they're not alone.
Yeah, someone asked me the other day, they said, if what happened to you didn't happen, where would you be? I said, I'd probably still be in North Carolina in law enforcement, which means that I wouldn't have my wife. We which means I wouldn't have my son. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be pastoring the church. And really, we can. If we try hard enough, we can look back and prove Romans 8:28, that all things work together for the good of those that love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. Mm-hmm. And so while it is difficult to say, well, if I could keep it from happening, I would. But if I did, then all of this other stuff wouldn't happen. So trying to come to a conclusion here. If you had, you're before a potential audience of 2 billion people, what would your message today be to those people?
Don't bottle your trauma up. It's not something that you want to preserve by bottling it up. Mm-hmm. If anything, you need to take the cork off in the form of going and telling somebody what happened, talking to them about it. And you're not damaged goods. You're fearfully and wonderfully made by God. Yes, terrible things happen in this life. It's just part of being a human being on planet Earth, fallen world. But God takes broken people and uses them all the time to do wonderful things. If only the perfect people were around to do things for God, nothing would get done. And so I'd encourage anybody out there, if you feel broken, if you feel like you're damaged, you're not alone. Go find somebody, talk to them, and then just remember that God has a purpose for you too.
Yeah. Adam, thank you for being here with us today on Doc Talks. I really appreciate it. Thank you for being able to use your story for good, because I know that's not always an easy thing. So we appreciate you being here today with us.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So thank you for being here with us today. Thank you for listening. Of course, I'm Doc Brian. You can find me at thedocbrian.com. You can find all of our Christian content at lifeword.org. Thank you so much for listening today, and we'll see you soon. Goodbye.